the Haunted Backroads of America, and live from the G&D Show Studio, this is your Ghost Man and Demon Hunter Show.
Doesn't that sound exciting to you?
Hey, welcome back, Shadow Nation. Welcome back to the one, the only, Mystifying Oracle Radio. Your Ghost Man and Demon Hunter Show, Demon Hunter!
Sean, the monster under my bed is upset that he hasn't been interviewed yet.
We can book him. Maybe next week, I don't know. Stitcher Smart Radio, Planet Paranormal, Action Audio Apps, are you listening? Because they want to know, so check them out. Tell them all about it at actionaudioapps.com. The SYL Project. Give some love, share some love today. The SYLProject.com. In case you guys were wondering, yes, those were all our homes and all the good people to the show that we were shouting out to that I should have said before I started shouting out. Welcome back, everybody. It's Sunday night.
Is it Sunday night?
I'm
afraid I worked yesterday, Sean, so I woke up this morning thinking today was Saturday.
That's what I heard. You worked. Why would you work last night? I mean, besides the, the obvious paying bills and money.
They said, hey, we've got this new thing called money that we'll give you some if you come into work. This is a great plan.
Yeah,
I like this plan.
I've heard about this money thing. Tell me more about this money you speak of.
It really is the root of all evil.
Anyway, guys, this is the Mystifying Oracle Radio. This is our 10th year, working our 10th year on the air, bringing you the biggest, brightest, in the maybe not the brightest, but the biggest and the best in the field of entertainment, horror, spookiness, general paranormal, everything, and goofy, and all the good stuff. So, when's our 10-year anniversary, man? We got to do something special.
Well, technically, our 10-year anniversary will be in November.
Okay, so we got official year then.
Yeah, it will be. We are working on year number 10, and that will celebrate the weekend that Sean and I sat down in Gettysburg and decided to start the Ghost Man and Demon Hunter Show.
Decided to brighten the world, absolutely. So, you guys might not know this, but Nathan and I, sometimes we can't be in studio together. He's in Connecticut. And
so
I'm in,
sad.
I'm in Indianapolis, Indiana. You guys wouldn't be able to tell, longtime listeners of the show. Of course, I'm in beautiful Indianapolis, Indiana. That's 10 degrees today. It's 10 degrees outside.
You crazy, cold-blooded people.
It's 10
degrees. We are at a lovely 30 degrees here in Connecticut.
It's summertime.
I went out with my coat off today, wearing shorts.
Were you on your motorcycle? Cycle?
Yesterday would have been a great day for the motorcycle if it wasn't already winterized and put up in the garage.
Right. Well, they say the best time of year for sickles are, autumn. That's the idea.
It is. It's a beautiful time of year to ride.
Yes.
But there are a couple downsides even then. When you're riding a motorcycle, you do not have the protection of the cage around your body that you have in a car.
You got to have the protection.
So when you hit a few wet leaves, it can be a scary thing. But even worse is you can't really leaf peep while you're riding a motorcycle.
What's a leaf peep?
Leaf peepers.
Okay. It's fancy.
When you live in New England, you get people coming up from the city to admire your foliage.
Right.
I have attended a few rock concerts where I admired the foliage myself. But when they come up to New England, they want to admire all the trees. Well, when you're riding a motorcycle, the bike will go wherever you look.
Right.
So if you're looking at a tree, you're going to ride the bike up the tree.
Yeah, which you've done before, right?
I rode it off a cliff.
There's
a difference.
Well, there is a difference, yeah. You shouldn't do either, kids, if you're listening to the show, but if you got to do one, I guess.
It's funny because I did do it once where I was riding along, Sean, and there was a gorgeous red-shouldered hawk just sitting alongside the road. And I looked over and thought, that is the coolest hawk I've ever seen. And I realized I was getting closer and closer to the hawk and not sticking to the highway because the bike was going off the road as I looked at the hawk. So
you see, this is this is the difference between us. Shadow Nation, this is the difference. He was saying, I was looking at a big, big, beautiful red, and I'm thinking he's going to say, did you say red?
Red-shouldered hawk.
Yeah, I thought you were going to say red, big-breasted, gorgeous woman.
Red bikini, yeah.
Yes, and you said a hawk, and I, yeah, I mean, my God, man. If I'm going to die, it's going to be staring at a woman's oversized bosom.
Well, Sean, let's be fair. I'm a little older. And in a few years, maybe you'll understand where I'm coming from.
No. I know where you're coming from. I'm not that young, man. I'm not that young. Well, I'm 40. I just turned 40. So anyway, what's going on?
You know, it's that difference of parking on top of a beautiful overlook when you're 45 with your wife by your side and going, isn't this beautiful? Yes. And parking at an overlook with your girlfriend when you're 18 and you don't even realize that there's this beautiful valley below because you're looking at other hills and valleys.
No, I understand. Yeah, I do understand. Yes, hills and valleys. Both equal. You know, you can appreciate them both equally, I think.
Yes.
If you
yes.
do it right. Anyway, Demon Hunter, without further ado.
Ado.
Tonight's guest. That's right. You hear the music, guys. She's a longtime friend of the show, good friend of the show, and she's shook the world with some late-breaking news this last week. You might have seen it on CNN, NBC, and many, many, many other news providers and carriers across this great nation of ours. Because history is about to change, or actually, it has. Tonight's guest, Marilyn K. Roach, author of Six Women of Salem. Marilyn K. Roach, our good friend, stops by. She's going to tell us all about it, guys. She's going to tell us about her work, her tireless work over the years of going back in the dark, dirty courtrooms to look for the ancient files from the 1600s to shed light on what was discovered just the last couple of months that was released. The information was released this week. Tonight, Marilyn K. Roach stops by to tell us how history will change forever, especially for a small little place known as Salem.
You do love that Salem.
I do. Marilyn K. Roach, author, friend of the show, Six Women of Salem. She's our guest tonight. That's what I get when I don't write out the intro, Nathan. I ramble on and I do my best, guys.
Well, for those of you who don't know, Sean and I do put this show together with a bit of spit and glue and some string that we found in the basement. So sometimes just before the show starts, the scotch tape holding our equipment together falls off. And next thing you know.
Yeah. We don't have any glue. And yeah. We're live on the air. Yeah, anyway, The Six Women of Salem. I mean, what a great book. We both, Marilyn came on last time because you and I, I've never been there. I believe you have, right?
I've driven through.
You've driven through. I've been.
I was on my way upstate. I didn't have time to stop. I wish I had stopped, but.
Well, we tried to get out there when we were filming that TV pilot deal, and we ended up going to Sleepy Hollow to look for the Headless Horseman instead.
Which is another place you'd always wanted to go. So.
Absolutely, absolutely. Although Sleepy Hollow was amazing. It takes nothing away. But Salem, to me, just has this feel. When I hear the name Salem, you know, it just has this feel about it that I've always been crazy about. So when Marilyn
I think
comes
of a up, talking cat and a teenage witch.
Well, yeah, that's Sabrina. No, that was, first time we found out about Marilyn, guys, it was on The Daily Show when Jon Stewart was doing it.
Yes, that was a great episode, I must admit.
Yeah, it was. And she came on, and Jon was asking her questions about the book and everything. So this is a hot-button topic, and I didn't want to go too much into it, of course, until she comes on tonight. But wow, Nathan, how many times do you see something for hundreds of years that's been thought a certain way, and then it's changed? Basically, it's going to end up rewriting at least Salem's history.
And you know there are going to be people arguing it left and right, Sean, because nobody wants to see anything change.
Because
by our very nature, we want things to stay the same.
Well, yeah, we're scared of change anyway.
I'm old and I'm afraid of change and I don't want these kids on my lawn.
So what else is going on, man, besides you working and lame? Anything?
Well, I didn't get to mention last week that I had gone to see a particular movie.
Oh, yeah. Star Wars.
Well, I'd gone to see Star Wars. We talked about Star Wars, but I also went to see, flew out of my head there. I was talking about a particular horror movie.
The Forest, right?
And I had mentioned Not Scary.
Yes.
Didn't want to give too much away because it had just come out. I didn't want people to spoil it for people.
Yeah.
But the premise of the story, Sean, is a young woman travels to Asia to try and find her sister, who was last seen going into a forest known for people who go in there to try and commit suicide.
Which is based on a true thing.
Right. So the entire premise of the story, a lot of fun. The special effects, not bad. The actual horror rating on a scale to 1 to 10, I'd give it a 0.4.
Really?
Doesn't even reach a 1 for being scary.
Wow. I mean, what's it missing?
It's tough. You know when you're sitting in there, Sean, and you know the jump scare is about to come, so you're not afraid.
Yeah.
And you know the way things are going to turn out, so you're not worried, or you're like, well, halfway through the movie, you're like, oh, well, that person's going to die. What a bummer.
So you've seen it coming.
Yeah. And it was so stereotypically formatted that there was no real fear to it during the entire movie.
So there's like no paranormal?
Oh, there's paranormal, but it's all based on the legend of the suicide forest.
Right.
And I don't know. I've never, gone into a forest to commit suicide, so I couldn't relate to it, maybe. Okay. But
well, maybe you... What are you trying to say there? Okay, anyway, it's funny you brought that up because I cannot pronounce the name of this forest, but I did look it up. It's in the Tenshi Mountains. Tenshi Mountains, the real forest, and it's called Aokigahara. Aokigahara Forest.
That sounds about right.
Also known as the Suicide Forest or Sea of Trees.
Yes, because if you look at it from the mountain, it looks like it is a green ocean. It just spreads out so far.
Let's see here. Because people have been saying for, years. Let's see here. Suicides. The forest is reportedly the most popular site for suicide in Japan and among the top three most popular sites for suicide in the world.
That's what
statistics vary, of course. But there were around 30 suicides documented every year during the period leading up to 1988. And in 03, I guess, Nathan, 105 bodies were found in the forest, exceeding the previous record of 78 in 2002. You got to admit, man, 105 bodies were found in this forest.
But if people travel from all over the country to commit suicide there, how many suicides occur in this country? There's just not one forest for people to do it in.
That's not even fun. I mean, you wouldn't even get a T-shirt for attempting that. You know, like the thrill, the thrill seekers out there. They're like, I went to this mountain and...
Which is kind of the basis of this story. You have to wonder if one of the sisters is just a thrill seeker in the story.
Yeah.
And that's why she went into the forest.
Yeah.
She's very interested in the macabre. Was she really going to commit suicide? What really happens to a person in the forest? None of it really affected me. Now, oddly enough, I watched on DVD yesterday a movie everybody told me was awful, and I had a lot of fun with. That was The Visit.
Oh, that was good. I rented that this weekend for the children.
Yeah, the recent M. Night Shyamalan movie.
Shyamalan-a-ding-dong.
What a twist.
Shyamalan.
Again, everybody got mad at me because I figured it out 20 minutes into the movie. Normally, I figure it out. I write it on a little piece of paper. I stick it in my pocket. When it's all done, I take out the piece of paper, see if I was right or not. But this time they actually asked me, what do you think is going to happen? And I said it, and then they were all mad at me because I told them what was going to happen. So, but I thought it was actually a fun movie. Even though I knew what was going to happen, he really gave it enough twists and turns that you didn't know how it was going to happen.
I'm sorry. M. Night Shyamalan stuff has been turds, people, in my opinion, since The Sixth Sense.
I like Signs.
Oh, I take it back. I take it back. Dare I say, yes, I like the Signs. Signs was good. It was an acquired. I had to watch it two or three times to really go, okay.
For me, the first time was the most exciting with Signs. After that, the second time you watched it to try and pick up the signs. You wanted to see everything that he's on it. After that, that's when it lost interest in me.
In you?
It lost its interest in me. I personally enjoyed... I was not a fan of the... I can't remember the name. The one with the girl lost in the woods.
Huh? Oh, yeah. The Village.
The Village, yes. Wasn't a super fan of that one. No, Chrissy liked that one. Girl in the Water, for what it was not a bad story. It just wasn't a horror, story.
Yeah.
It was a children's scary bedtime story.
And it was spooky.
Yeah. And it is the bedtime story he was telling to his children, and he promised his children he would make it into a movie, and that's exactly what he did. Mm. So that for what it was, that was a good story. The more I watch Unbreakable, the more I like it.
Yeah, it was all right. Yeah, yeah.
It's very slow.
Yeah.
And I personally, what was that? The Happening. Everybody took a poop on The Happening. I personally thought that the premise of the story was really good. I just think Mark Wahlberg was the wrong actor to play the lead.
No, I think that was, I think you're right. I don't know, Mark Wahlberg, whatever. But the story kept me fascinated because that could happen. You know, you think about something like that, and it's like, wow. But, hey, I wanted to throw in there real quick, Nathan, since we're doing a, Ebert and whatever, Siskel and Ebert deal here. Your friend that we really appreciate, really respect, actor Alan Rickman. Of course, the British screen actor, the great, he died this week at 69. A lot of people are dropping, man.
Yeah, and I have to say...
Of course, he's from Harry Potter, Die Hard.
Lot of people will always remember him from Robin Hood, where he played the Sheriff of Nottingham. For me, I remember that, but Die Hard was where he played Hans Gruber.
Yes.
For me, that will be him forever.
Did you say yippee-ki-yay? Yeah,
To call him Snape just isn't fair.
No. For me, Galaxy Quest. Remember that? By Grathdarb's hammer, you shall be avenged.
Yes.
To see him.
And Galaxy Quest, what another great movie that just gets overlooked.
Yeah, well, it had Tim in there. Alan, he just kind of disappeared. Have you heard from Tim lately?
No, he doesn't talk to Emmy anymore.
I don't understand that. I wonder if he's living back in Michigan or what. We need to get him back on the show and talk to the guy. I don't know what he's been up to, man. But, rest in peace, Alan. Yeah, you will be missed. Yeah. What a great guy. And then Grizzly Adams passed away this week.
And speaking of the first, the Sheriff of Nottingham passing away with Alan Rickman, and unfortunately now I don't have the name in front of me, but the gentleman who played the voice of Robin Hood.
Yeah, the Fox.
The Fox, Robin Hood, in the Disney animation of Robin, he passed away.
Yeah, I know.
Grizzly Adams, like you said.
Yeah. It's a shame, man. Grizzly Adams. Who else? There was a couple others.
David Bowie.
David Bowie,
David Bowie died last week, Sean. His death was announced while we were doing the show.
Yeah.
And it didn't pop up in our news feed when we were doing the show. So it popped up right after the show, so we didn't get to announce it. I was a David Bowie fan.
You were? Growing up.
I was a child of the 80s. I mean, what was I going to do? I was a David Bowie fan.
Yeah,
not to mention Labyrinth. What a fabulous movie.
Labyrinth, that was good. I always thought Bowie should have stayed away from the leather pants and stuff. But, I thought they all should have. But Bowie was good. He was good.
He didn't play music. He didn't make music that was meant to be popular.
Yeah.
He made the music he wanted to make, and people loved the music because he made it. And so in that, he was a true creative genius.
Yes, he was. Rest in peace, David Bowie.
Too many people died this week, Sean.
Yeah,
it's a downer moment. What can we do to lift this up, Sean?
In the news. It's always fresh, guys. It's always exciting. It's strange and weird, and it's straight from the G&D show vaults. And it starts right now. I think I got that all in there.
Hey, Sean, that's right, folks. It's G&D in the news. That's weird news that Sean and I pick right out of the paper because we like the titles. We haven't read them in advance, which means we make a lot of mistakes. Every time we make a mistake, you take a drink. That's the G&D drinking game. If you're doing anything right now, like driving a car while listening to the G&D show, please don't play the G&D drinking game. And if anything important is coming on up tonight, like having to attend a funeral of a lost celebrity, please listen responsibly.
You want me to go first here or what?
Sure, go ahead, sir.
Clean the old vocal pipes out there. Okay, this guy wants popcorn banned inside movie theaters. Oh, my God. This is from our friends at HuffPost Weird News. Thanks, you guys, so much. This is a whack job. I got to read this. Here we go, guys. Ready, Shadow Nation? Enough.
I'm ready, Sean.
That's right. Enough is enough, Nathan, for a frustrated movie fan who's calling for popcorn to be banned from theaters because he says it's too noisy. Mike Shoten, 39, from Newcastle in northeast England, says his enjoyment of films is constantly ruined by others chomping down on snacks. His recent viewing of Star Wars, The Force Awakens, was spoiled by children wrestling and chowing down on popcorn, according to the Daily Express. Dude, you're going to have to calm down. You're going to have to calm down, bro. I'm thinking he's childless, right?
And I'm thinking if you're going to go to a movie theater is not a perfectly silent place.
No, dude.
People laugh. Yeah. People scream when they get scared. Right. People have to get up to go use the restroom. People open candy wrappers.
Yeah. Well, I remember Star Wars.
You want total silence when you're watching the movie, wait till it comes out on DVD and build a home theater.
I went the opening week of Star Wars because everybody stood and clapped when LucasArts came up or Lucasfilms and then the Star Wars title. I wanted that. I wanted to experience that. But I remember seeing a guy like he was appalled that people were clapping at the beginning. What a douche. Anyway.
Well, as you know, I used to work for a company that showed movie, Sean, and
yes.
I remember when the One Direction movie came out. Promoting the One Direction movie of the young pop stars, and lines out the door of preteen girls waiting to get in to see it. And you know, it's a concert. The movie is a concert, and it follows them along on their concert tour. And the girls were screaming and they were shouting, and we had made an announcement that they weren't allowed to videotape with their phones and anything like that. But I actually had a mother come out and complain that her daughters couldn't hear the movie because there was so much noise going on. And we looked at her and said, if you'd like to bring them out right now, we'll give you passes to come back sometime when there aren't an entire theater full of screaming preteen girls. But,
right.
You know, she went, no, they want to see it tonight.
Right.
Well, of course they want to see it tonight because the excitement is being there with everybody else.
It's so exciting. Anyway.
Personally, Sean, if you don't like popcorn, don't go to the movies.
Yeah. So he wants the sale and consumption to be outlawed in the UK movie houses. But so far, he's only gained 126 signatures on petitionbuzz.com, which is no big deal. You could petition, you know, people should throw their underwear away and you'd get 126 signatures.
We got more signatures than that to get us taken off the air, Sean.
Well, that was just on Sunday night, you know. That's any given day. Anyway, that's way less than 573,000 who have so far signed a petition on the UK government's official website calling for the GOP presidential candidate Donald Trump to be banned from visiting the United Kingdom. Go Trump! Wow, already making pals. Shoten complains on the petition site that the theater chains bombard us with constant reminders to be quiet during the film, and then they sell the loudest food known to man. There you go, guys. He hates popcorn. The UK hates popcorn.
And if they hate popcorn, how can you trust anything that they do? I mean, obviously, if they hate popcorn, they're wrong.
Therefore, their
petition against Donald Trump must be wrong.
Except for our members of the Shadow Nation in the UK. You guys are cool.
Yes, you guys are great. And if you don't like Donald Trump, that's fine.
Yeah, really. It's no sweat for us.
Because remember, nobody on our show is ever really wrong.
Uh-huh.
This guy's not on our show, so we can say he's wrong.
Absolutely.
Go ahead. You're wrong.
Blah, blah. You're the next
one. So, Sean, my worst nightmare came true this week.
Oh, my God. You woke up naked in front of your entire school.
No, that happened years ago.
Oh, okay.
But a 5-foot black tip shark found in Florida swimming pool.
Oh, man.
In Lake Worth, Florida, comes to us from the UPI News on January 16th. a condominium resident in Florida was met with a shock when she discovered a live shark in the building's swimming pool.
Okay.
The 5-foot black tip shark was found in the Marina's K condominium pool in Lake Worth. I got those all right. Lake Worth. And removed by Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission officers, according to the Sun Sentinel report. Okay. The woman also reported seeing two men running away from the scene at the time of her discovery, and the fish and wildlife officers contacted management after noticing surveillance cameras in the area.
Oh.
This incident is the focus of ongoing and active investigations by the Fish and Wildlife Commission, spokesman Robert Kepler told The Patch. The shark was released into the international waterway after being removed from the pool.
Wow.
That would be like, Sean, I would have the heart attack of a lifetime.
So how did he adjust to the chlorine and the fresh
water? I'm sure he probably wasn't in the pool long enough.
Okay.
They probably did have to treat him, though, because sharks have trouble with fresh water.
All right.
Maybe it was a saltwater pool.
I don't know. Okay,
it doesn't say.
You would think
they would put that in the news. Come on, UPI.
We need to know these facts in case Nathan finds a shark in his swimming pool.
Now I can never have a saltwater pool. Even though they are the best pools, I can't have one because there may be sharks in them.
There could be sharks in it. Animals kept in deep freeze for 30 years brought back to life. Thanks, friends at Huffington Post. Here goes a story right here, and we are at 7:28, so I'm going to rush through this one real quick. We were running late tonight, guys, so we're trying to crunch time it. Microscopic creatures kept frozen for more than 3 decades have been successfully brought back to life. The 1-millimeter-long tardigrades, drink up, guys,
have a drink, folks,
were collected from a frozen moss sample in Antarctica in 1983. According to the new paper published in the journal... Cryobiology. I got that right, but I'm sure...
Cryobiology?
No, it doesn't say that. It says cry, and there's no O there. They must have misprinted. Yeah. Japan's National Institute of Polar Research stored the 8-legged segmented critters at -4 Fahrenheit for just over 30 years. They thawed...
Now, just one question, Sean. Isn't this how the movie The Thing started?
Yeah, that's what I was getting ready to say. It's kind of spooky there. Anyway, -4 Fahrenheit, guys. They stored them for 30 years. They thawed and revived two of the animals, which are also known as water bears or moss piglets, in early 2014. So technically, Nathan, the future has arrived.
Dun, dun, dun. Now they can de-thaw John Wayne.
And Disney, his head.
Yes. Disney's not frozen. John Wayne.
What will... John Wayne's frozen?
That's right.
Nah. Is there any actual human that's... No, that's not right. John Wayne was buried. He lies so bad.
He's now, not dead. He's frozen.
Everybody said that Walt Disney's head had been severed and buried.
No, it was not. That is a legend.
How do you know? I always heard that Walt Disney's head was severed. His head was severed, and it was put on ice underneath. When you first walk in Orlando, it has the picture of him and Disney, the statue. That is where Disney's head is at the base.
It's actually his head on top of the statue. They just encased it in bronze.
It is. Whoa,
hey, Sean, coming up in the news, let's remind people what TV shows are coming out in the next couple weeks and months.
Oh, yeah. Well, you got quite a bit, Nathan. You got The X-Files.
Coming out.
Yeah. You got The Walking Dead returning in February. And that's about all I know.
Well, those are the two I was thinking of. But when does The X-Files return to television?
Well, The X-Files officially, I had that up the other day, returns, I believe it's January 24th, Sunday.
So this coming weekend?
Yeah, this next coming weekend. And it will be a Sunday-Monday deal. And as you know, we spoke to our good friend Dean Haglund when he was on the show. Oh, wait, before we get on that. The Smoking Man got us, dude. He got us. William came on the show, if you remember right, and he said, you would ask him, you said, hey, William, you know, what do you think? Are you going to, what was it?
Are you going to make an appearance on The X-Files, the new series? And he said, well, I don't know if that's even possible. If you remember, I got blown up at the end of the last.
Yeah.
And we said, well, the aliens will have saved you. They'll clone you and bring you back. And he went, well, I guess that's one possible explanation.
Yeah. And then he came on. And we were like, you're not going to come on, dude. Okay. So listen, we're gonna play the trailer here. But, you know, it's in the background.
What will seem like an attack on America.
Attack on America by Russia, like Russian or whatever. Then you got Fox Mulder back. And I go all the way to the end.
Police us and spy on us here.
Seen this. I go all the way to the end. Let me see if I can find it. And I'm thinking,
we have a small problem.
I'm thinking,
will it be a flashback? Will he be a continuing character? I'm looking forward to finding out, Sean.
Hey, William, are you going to be on the next X-Files episode?
We have a small problem.
X-Files, January 2016, guys, next Sunday on Fox.
And following up in February with Walking Dead, that's when, you know, Rot Talk will return to the show.
Rot Talk. What is Rot Talk, Nathan?
Rot Talk is when Sean and I discuss what we saw last week on The Walking Dead and what we think is going to happen that evening and where the show is going. It is not spoiler-free, folks, so remember, when you listen to Rot Talk, be prepared to hit that fast-forward button if you don't want your viewing pleasure ruined by two goofy guys talking about the show.
Because we're two goofy guys.
Two goofy guys.
Anyway, guys, we got to go to break. Tonight's guest...
Da-da-da!
That's the wrong button right there. That's the news, which we already did. Man, I'm off. Tonight's guest, guys, author of Six Women of Salem, good friend of the show, Marilyn K. Roach. She's a historian, a researcher, guys, and an amazing author. Daily Show with Jon Stewart. She's been seen on TV many times. She does talks and research around the town of Salem, and she's done it for years, guys. And tonight, she's going to come on the show and tell us about her late-breaking new finds in Salem that will change history. Tonight, right here on the Mystifying Oracle Radio with Marilyn K. Roach, author, Six Women of Salem. Yeah. I can't wait for that, Nathan. I cannot wait. Anyway, guys, each week we play an independent band, one we know, we love, we support the little man on this show because we know how hard it is to get your stuff out. Tonight, it's a great honor. Good friend of the show, actually, and a friend of ours, Kate Eppers. She's from Salem, Massachusetts. She's I think she's going to be a huge star, guys. She is an artist. And she's doing great things. We'll have more information on her on the Facebook page, Ghost Man and Demon Hunter Show, to come later tonight. But tonight, one of her, well, it's not a debut of her song, but we're going to play one of her songs. It's For Me, There's Only You, guys. And this is one of her newer songs. And Demon Hunter.
Ghost Man.
Shadow Nation. We'll be right back.
We'll be right back.
The truth.
this is Matt Baglio, author of The Rite, The Making of a Modern Exorcist, and you're listening to The Ghost Man and Demon Hunter Show. I am no.
Hey, welcome back, Shadow Nation, to the one, the only Mystifying Oracle Radio, your Ghost Man and Demon Hunter show. Tonight's guest is a good friend of the show and known for her work on the 1980 Ghost in the Shed, 1979 CBS Library, and 1996 The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. Tonight, Shadow Nation, changing history. Please help us welcome good friend of the show, author of Six Women of Salem, Miss Marilyn K. Roach. Marilyn, how are you doing tonight?
Fine, thanks.
Thank you for coming back on.
My pleasure.
I told Nathan, I said, oh, my God, I seen this story in the news all week. I said, oh, I got to get Marilyn. I got to get a hold of her. So I called Nathan, and I said, we have her number. It's in our files from, you know, our guest in the past. He says, I cannot find it. And I look it everywhere. So I had to go through the channels. We dug deep, but we found you.
Oh yes.
Now you're in the G&D folder. You're yes. We have you for life now.
Oh. Oh well, there you go.
Of course. Hey, Marilyn. Before last time, we didn't get to talk about some of the, you know, ghosts and hauntings around Salem. Some of the more different type stories. And I was looking up. Didn't you do a book about encounters with invisible world? The invisible world.
Oh, it's fiction. It's a children's book.
Children's
based
book.
Based on New England legends.
When did you
My
do
goodness,
that?
That was a while back. 70-something, 80?
I did my homework.
you found about the ghost in the shed. That was a long time ago.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. They did make somebody made a film out of it.
Yeah. I want somebody to write a film about us, Nathan, someday and do our hard work. But you know what? You guys, and you know how much I'm into it out there, Maryland and Salem,
mm-hmm.
and the history, and you know my family attachments with Martha Sparks and being kicked in the head.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah. And I still research that to the day, but you helped me out with that last time. You know, can you just tell our listeners, for the new listeners, a little bit about yourself and some of your books and how you got involved with the whole Salem witch trials and history.
Oh, yeah. Well, I read everything I can get my hands on. I went to school to be an illustrator at Massachusetts College of Art and started writing my own books with my illustrations, which, of course, were children's books, including the one you mentioned, The Encounters with the Invisible World, kind of stole the title from Cotton Mather and changed it a bit. Well, steal from the best.
That's right.
But back during the bicentennial of the revolution in 1975, the bicentennial, all sorts of local history was rediscovered, and Salem, the city, put out a guidebook, which I happened to find, and decided I would go up on the train and see it for myself, finally, because I was reading a little bit about the witch trials then. And I went up and fell in love with the place. It's a beautiful town, and city rather, and it has a lot of history other than this. But this was before the tourism really hit hard, and some of the displays I saw, I thought, wasn't quite the way I had been reading about it,
right.
And that I ought to look into it, and that was a start of the 27-year quest for the first adult book that I did on the witch trials. Salem Witch Trials, a day-by-day chronicle of a community under siege.
Oh, my gosh.
And after that, there was no turning back. And that came out in 2002. Yeah, but new stuff keeps turning up. New information.
Well, I first seen it on CNN this week. Talk about new stuff just kind of turns up. We didn't hear about it, you know, from you for a long time. And then you hear Marilyn K. Roach was in on this. You know, what is going on in Salem right now? Because people all over the United States, all over the world, have been hearing about this, that...
Apparently.
Yeah, that we've got it wrong.
I saw a link to a story that was issued in the Netherlands, so it's spread.
Yeah.
Well, a number of us wanted to make certain that the place was respected and protected, mm-hmm. and we hope marked in a restrained way. But the actual knowledge of the place was verified in 1900 by one of our heroes, the lawyer and historian Sidney Perley. He was a lawyer in Salem. Right. He seems to have read every deed and will in the courthouse on his time off, and he had figured out where all the land ownership and where the houses were back in as of 1700 and before that. So he knew where things were then, because it's changed a bit since then. They filled in some of the shoreline and the rivers and so forth.
Yeah.
And he investigated one of the local traditions that the lower part of Gallows Hill, Proctor's Ledge, that everybody's heard about now, mm-hmm. that was the spot where the hangings had occurred, rather than the alternate tradition, which is the very top of the hill. And it's dramatic when you're up there, but it's impractical if you want a public execution as a warning of what not to do or this happens to you. You want to put it where people can see it. And the lower ledges is right by the main road leading into town, but it was outside of town. It was at the edge of town then. And it was also public land because it was part of the common pasture that was at the edge of town, so right. They didn't have to, you know, use anybody's backyard for this.
Mm-hmm.
And various traditions and anecdotes remembered that this was the place, and they'd pointed out, and even future President John Adams, he's taking a stroll in the 1750s, I think. He's still a lawyer at this point. He's in Salem with relatives. And he takes a stroll out that way and sees the spot where he says the witches were hanged. Alleged witches, John, actually.
Right.
But, you know, it's how people talk about it. And there's various anecdotes about seeing the spot, but the question is, where were people looking from? And let's see, back in 1997, I came across one of the real vague statements in the court papers for the witch trials, where one of the women, Rebecca Eames, has been arrested. She's been brought down from Boxford, which is north of Salem. So she'd have to have come down that same road past where the hangings would take place. Yeah. And it was the same day, August 19th, that, well, let's see, there were five people, Reverend Burroughs, John Proctor, George Jacobs, Samuel Willard, I think, and Martha Carrier were hanged. So they're coming down towards Salem, and her guards see that this is going on, and they don't want to miss this. They want to see that. So they leave her, presumably under whichever guard drew the short straw,
yeah,
at a nearby house and go off and see the excitement. And then they bring her into town where she's questioned by the magistrates. And I think it was Hawthorne. I can't swear to that at the moment. It was probably either Hawthorne or Colin. But they summarize the notes of what they asked her rather than actual question and answer, unfortunately. But it says she was asked if she was at the executions. She said she was at the house below the hill. She saw a few folk.
Yeah.
And there were only so many houses along that stretch of road then. And most of them, you could have a clear view of Proctor's Ledge.
Was that the main road?
Maryland? It was then. There's a lot more roads now.
Right.
It's Boston Street now. It was the road to Boston. The main road out of town, Essex Street, and then it turns north past the ledges and then goes around that big outcropping of hill and the common pastures and heads to Boston. It's roundabout because it's going around real rocky places and marshy places and things that aren't a problem now.
Yeah.
And it veers off so that if you go up that way, it heads towards Salem Village and Boxford and points east and north. So there were only so many roads to come by, and that narrows down where they could have been.
Mm.
And it fits the neighborhood tradition. One thing, it's called Proctor's Ledge because of a later owner who happened to be a descendant of the John Proctor who died there that day.
Wow.
Yeah. And that went at the beginning of the 18th century, the town sold off some of that pasture land to farmers and small tradesmen along the edges.
Yeah. So you say John Proctor, Maryland, everybody goes, Daniel Day-Lewis.
Yeah, right, Daniel Day-Lewis.
Which was a great portrayal.
His grandson, Thorndike Proctor, bought one of those plots. He wasn't the original buyer, but he was like the second or third person to own it. And it stayed in that family until, coincidentally, 1892, when the last of them died and cousins got the land. It was much reduced by then, and there were a lot of factories in the area. And it got sold and resold and divided and recombined. And I went through the registry of deeds and looked at all the deeds and figured out where things were. But the tradition stayed because, for one thing, I think because the Proctor family lived around there.
And now it's a Walgreens.
The Walgreens is on the flat ground in front of the rocks by the road. And there's a strip of city-owned land that has trees and bushes and possibly poison ivy, I'm not sure.
Oh, yeah.
But unfortunately, because it just looks like an empty lot, people have dumped things in it from time to time, and the people who would like to keep it clean, clear it out, and so forth. But we'd like it respected a little more than that.
But aren't we fortunate when we look back at history that the land was at least preserved in such a way that you can still find it? It wasn't totally flattened and a giant factory built on top of it.
Yeah, I mean, there are houses up there, and there were factories in the vicinity, but there is a piece that's not covered, and we hope it always stays that way.
Right.
1936, the city bought two plots contiguous, and it's in the city reports for several years under public lands. That one's listed as Witch Memorial Land, which is alleged witches.
Right.
it's listed. And then it kind of got forgotten and rediscovered. But the city is well aware of it now and wants to make sure it's respected.
Marilyn, how did it all start? Who approached you and said, because everybody knows you're amazing. Heck, I'm out here in Indiana, and if I needed something found, I would say, call Marilyn K. Roach, please, because I try to tell these people that listen in, you've been in the back rooms of these courtrooms with the old files, and you've seen the handwritten, documents from that era. Things that some people will never be able to see, you've held, and you've burnt the midnight oil looking up and researching these things.
You can see most of them online now, actually.
You got to hold them, though.
carefully. A lot of this was microfilm and transcriptions.
How were you approached about this? Did they come at you and say, we need you to do this, we need to put a cap on it?
Oh, well, no, not exactly. Well, and, in 97, I found that little piece of information and self-published a small booklet that sold up there in Salem.
Yeah.
But, I've been in touch with people people with similar interests in Salem who are with the historical places. So that, one of our number in the project is a filmmaker, and he was in touch with the town. When he made an introduction to the witch trials that runs at the National Park Service.
Oh, okay.
It visitor center up there. So he worked with with one of the professors, Benjamin Ray of University of Virginia, and he must have been in contact with the director at the witch house, so-called, which is Jonathan Corwin's home that still exists, but the city owns that, and the present director is putting it on a nice historical basis, and she's been doing great things, and also actually physically picking up trash at the site over the years. She deserves credit for that. So we sort of all knew each other or knew of each other's work, and then the Professor Baker, Tad Baker, and Peter Sebluck, who teach at Salem State, they have done archaeological investigations before in Maine, I believe. I know one. And Tad teaches a course in the witch trials. So so we all got together and thought that we should, you know, really make an effort to see that this is protected and marked, or at least acknowledged that this is worth preserving and taking care of. And that was about 5 years ago. Some of the news stories made it sound like we didn't know anything and then we spent 5 years borrowing.
Right.
But, you know, Sidney Perley figured it out, and then there were a few bits and pieces after that, the little snippet I just read to you.
Oh, yeah.
And let's see, around that time, Ben Ray at University of Virginia, and what's his name, Chris Giss, who's the most technical guy down there, did computerized viewshed analysis.
Okay.
Which I hadn't heard of before, but it was quite thrilling.
Hold on, I got to Google that, Marilyn.
Sounds like something we need in our ghost hunting kit, Sean.
Well, it might work. Help. You take topographical maps with the lines on them, and it was superimposed over an aerial view, which was probably Google or Bing. And you can tell by doing the math somehow. I'm not doing this. I'm not a technical. That if you're standing at a certain spot, can you see what you're hoping to see, like Proctor's Ledge, or is a hill in the way, or is the top of Gallows Hill more likely? And that pointed to Proctor's Ledge because it takes the topography into account, but the buildings that are now in the way aren't factored into this, so they're not a problem. And a lot of times when you're trying to see something historical from a certain place,
yeah,
you're looking at a brick wall because there's something in the way.
Right.
So this pointed to Proctor's Ledge, and that seemed like a good verification.
Now, I personally think that when they do provide us with the, when they do finally put up a marker there, that it should list the pardons of the witches.
That would be nice. Well, at least the names of the 19 who suffered there.
Well, that's what I was going to bring up, Marilyn, because you know out at Gallows Hill now or surrounding the old burying point, you have the beautiful monuments of those that were alleged victims. Or, I'm sorry, alleged victims. Were victims.
They're real victims alleged. Perfect.
Thank you. I need Marilyn to go with me everywhere and tell them what I really mean, Marilyn, because I...
Sorry.
No, I'm serious. I can't talk tonight. And, you know, it's beautiful out there. You know, was there any problems with the local tour companies? I mean, really, we've got it wrong for years, even when this man came forward, I'm sorry, in 1900s, the lawyer Sidney Perley, when he came forward and he said, hey, this is the way it is, they still didn't change it. They still said, no, Gallows Hill is where it happened. And
that's where most people went.
Yeah, and the tours and everything like that. Have you guys met any kind of resistance? Assure you will, people coming forward going, now, wait a minute, you're wrong.
Right. Well, a couple of neighbors weren't happy about it. There was an illegal, as far as I know, because I don't get up the Salem as easily as people who drive. But,
right.
Apparently, there was a wrongly parked car that's in the way. It is a neighborhood, and it's a narrowish street and a sharp curve, so that it really can't handle crowds.
Yeah.
Yes, the memorial in the middle of town is very good if there isn't a lot of Halloween crowds around.
Right.
But, yes, it lists them and the days that they died so that you can remember. And, of course, Giles Corey was pressed to death somewhere else, and he's in that memorial.
Now, we know where Giles met his fate, right? We do know that location?
Near the jail.
Near the jail.
I did have an article on where that was in a genealogy magazine.
Oh, my gosh. I got to read right this one.
It was pretty much right next to where the jail was, I believe.
Okay.
And I gave my reasons for it.
Do you think that the town will move because of, I mean, the tourist? Salem has to admit, the tourist brings in huge amounts of money and helps the community. I know that the Proctor's Ledge, it's a place that should be respected, absolutely. And
You can see it from the main road, too.
Oh, okay.
From Walgreens, it's pretty clear, the rocky part of it.
Well, some have already said they're going to put a big plaque up there. Do you know any plans they got going on for something else?
It hasn't been discussed yet, really. And we want something that's not big, it is, but acknowledges them and what they went through, and presumably their names too, I would hope.
So, but preferably, you know, not a 50-foot broomstick.
No,
no, and you know. Go ahead,
oh,
Marilyn.
Back. Oh, on the 1892, there was interest in this. That's when the souvenir witch spoon was invented by a local jeweler, and it really kind of started the tourism.
What was that?
Pardon me.
What was that? So,
the witch.
Yeah.
Oh, little, you know, the little souvenir spoon things from, you know, souvenir of such and such a place.
Yeah, yeah.
It had a little, a witch and a broomstick and on the handle and so forth. That seems to have been the first of them. But there was a movement to mark the spot then, and they were thinking the top of the hill, which is the ultimate spot. That Nathaniel Hawthorne and the historian, politician Charles Upham, who wrote the first history of it, thought that it was the top of the hill, so that one has gained a lot of following. So they were going to build, they had this plan for a granite tower, 3 stories tall,
wow,
that you could climb up, and it's a lookout, and you could look over the town and think about the people who actually weren't hanged there.
Right.
But it kind of fills up, it fills up the space, so we don't want to replace the space with something else that would be a focal point.
I love the way you broke it down, Marilyn. You could climb up this beautiful tower and think about the people that weren't hung there.
Yeah, right. Apparently, it was the sort of thing that they did a lot of on Civil War battlefields.
Yes, Gettysburg, places
but
that, like that.
But then you can look over the battlefield and see where people had been moved around, whereas this is different.
Yeah.
Now, I have a question for you, Marilyn, because I've, you know, a lot of what so many of us know from the Salem witch trials and things like that, we get from the movies.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, just how we pick things up these days. And being a kind of slight fanatic about the Old West, one of the lines that always stuck in my mind was when I learned the difference between what it meant to be hanged by the neck till dead or death by hanging.
Oh, what is the difference?
The difference was in where the knot was placed. If you were ordered to be hanged by the neck till dead, the knot was placed at the back of the neck, so you choked to death.
Mm.
And if it was death by hanging, it was placed to the side of your neck so that when you dropped, all the weight snapped your neck and you died instantly.
Mm.
So a murderer might get hanged by the neck till, might get death by hanging, where his neck snapped instantly. But a horse thief, who was the worst of all people, might get death by hanging. So do we have any idea what was when these ladies were hanged?
That's a good question.
Was it a torturous death where they did the jig, they suffocated, or was it a quick death? Do we know?
I have heard that it was more like strangulation in those days, but I've also heard that it was, and I, this was just heard in one place, that it was a slip knot rather than the hangman's noose.
Oh, so it would have been a death by hanging.
It would have been slower. I got the impression, but I've been conned
by the neck,
too, that knot, the hangman's knot that you see all the time, that it hadn't quite been invented yet, but I can't verify that.
So it
but
would have been
apparently it wasn't all that quick. And there's certainly no trap door. They're standing on a ladder, and it's kicked out from under them.
Ooh.
They mentioned going up the ladder. It was kind of a euphemism for being hanged.
Wow.
Gee, nowadays it means moving up in business, which is about
the corporate ladder.
Yeah.
But then if it's a cutthroat business, you never know.
Yeah, see, that's true.
And you wind up putting the noose around your own neck.
Right.
You know, I read an article because, as you can imagine, the net's going crazy this week with the news out of Salem. That Marilyn was a part of finding and researching. The Devil in Old Salem, Proctor's Ledge, the real Gallows Hill, ? And there's still people out there, it's already started, saying, you know, there's really no hardcore evidence that says, you know, even though you just went through it here on the show. But, you know, what was amazing to me, I'm going through right now the comments, 20, 30 comments, all these direct descendants, great grandchildren, DNA tested approved people, and they're saying they're alleged, you know, to be these descendants, Edward Bishop's family, stuff like that, Bridget Bishop. Mm-hmm. And they're saying, you know, a lot of them are saying we're outraged that this is being brought up again.
Why? Really?
That's what I didn't understand. And I'm seeing these.
Some descendants have been pleased with it, according to what I've heard. People have contacted the Salem newspaper.
Yeah.
And...
Yeah, and I see
know
that
what,
too.
You know what, Sean? People want to be heard, and you're only heard when you're arguing.
Right.
So they want to bring it up so they can argue.
Right. And that's what I was going to say. And the next question was, Marilyn, have you got involved in anything like that? Any kind of hate emails coming out of this stuff? Anything like that from people?
Well, Professor Baker's been handling the contact.
Okay.
But I don't know. Although I had heard that the Salem newspaper got some pleased correspondence with descendants.
Right.
I mean, they were not what they were accused of, and they have been, you know, that their reputations have been legally cleared, so that their bravery and the fact that it was wrong needs to be acknowledged.
And the more attention brought to it, the more people recognize the wrong that was done to them.
Yes.
You know,
they were brave. I mean, they told the truth.
Right.
Even though it didn't help them.
They could have thrown out somebody else's name and stuck somebody else up on that hill.
Or
at the bottom of the hill.
right. It's all part of one big granite mass. I believe that even some of the other taller parts to the side are all part of the same, but this is on the lower part that's more easily viewable from the public road.
Well, you know, I think Salem, to me, when I learned about it when I was a child in school, has always taught the world in the United States a history, a valuable history about how people can turn on it. It's a experiment, really. It's not an experiment. It's something that we learn from.
And you would, learning experience.
A learning experience. And I see this in the comments, and I see the people, and they get so hateful, and they start arguing about, well, this is wrong, and this is... And, you know, it takes me back, Marilyn, to, you know, I'm going to ask you, you know, tell everybody how it started and all that, because a lot of people, believe it or not, some people don't know about the witch trials. They know some ladies were hung, and that was it. But it shows me here that even to this day... We can't agree on some of the smallest things, and when someone brings in a new idea, a lot of people are scared of it, and they outcast you for no reason whatsoever and get very angry. What do you think about that? What do you think about, you know, back then when the Salem witch trials, I know we got into it a little bit last time, what do you think that teaches us, the most important lesson today that we could take from the witch trials?
Well, there were a lot of pressures at the time that were very real by any definition. And I think it was one awful thing after another. There was a war with Canada.
Right.
There were the smallpox. The economy was not good. They'd lost the charter. So Massachusetts was not operating legally. And England was going to tell them how things were, and they were hoping to have some kind of self-rule, which we did, but eventually there was a revolution over it. And let's see, and there were neighborhood stresses about whether Salem Village could be its own town or not, which took a couple of generations more for that to happen. And neighborhood quarrels and probably a lot of personal ones we don't really know about anymore. But it all sort of came together, as Tad Baker says, in a perfect storm. And it was just one more thing that triggered a complete breakdown when they thought that there was some evil magic going on. Because at January, actually, a couple of the girls who lived in the parsonage were acting oddly, seemed to be ill from something, and they tried home remedies, and they called in local physicians, and that didn't help either, and finally one of the doctors, nothing like getting a medical man, he opined that it was probably they were under an evil hand, which means they were bewitched.
Okay.
And still the family didn't do anything beyond home remedies, but a neighbor thought she was going to be helpful, and instructed the two slaves in the family in a bit of English folklore. It was supposed to be counter magic to repel whatever bad thing had been projected towards the two children. And they did a little spell with making a little witch cake, so-called, feeding it to the dog. Mm-hmm. Presumably the chewing of it and the digesting of it would hurt the supposed witch who had cast it. But the result was, and I suppose the girls knew they were doing this and expected the worst, so they just get worse and start hallucinating or saying anyway that they could see things coming after them and feeling pinches. And there are psychological reactions to it. You feel a prickling of the skin and shortness of breath, and if they think that that's a witch after them, then they get more scared, and it's a vicious cycle.
Right.
So they probably, people would ask them who the witches were after them, not so that they figured there must be one. And if they suggested people, or they were remembering some gossip or something that they'd overheard, they started to name names, and that led to the first of the arrests. And at the 1st of March, it was a leap year that year, as it is this year, actually. The first arrests were on the 29th of February. And on the 1st of March was the first hearing. And that's what the records of the actual conversations in court is from the hearings. That's where the notes come from. It's not the actual trial yet. And two of the women, Sarah Osborne and Sarah Good, deny it, the charge, but the slave woman, Tituba, who has fewer resources, she eventually gets bullied into comments they take as a confession, and she eventually names anybody that they suggest. She says that there are others from Boston and others in the neighborhood, and so people go looking for who else might be those witches. And all every old quarrel got remembered, I guess. But there were more. Yeah. But the more people who were arrested in the next several months, the worse the panic. It didn't calm anything down, and it certainly wasn't getting rid of the supposed army of Satan there. So the trials began in June, because the new charter that made Massachusetts legal again came back in May, at the end of May. That was brought back, and they could start up the government again. There'd been an interim government, which was pretty much the same, but they certainly could not put it. They did not feel that they could put anybody to death without, you know, the king's approval by having the charter.
Right.
So the trial start in June with Bridget Bishop, who had been suspected before, but got survived that. But so she seems like somebody people would suspect. She had the reputation that she might have been a witch. And she had a kind of a snappish, pranky persona, which if you're getting called a witch, you're not going to be cheerful about it.
Right.
So they find her guilty, which she denies it, of course, and she's the first to hang. And June and July, Rebecca Nurse and others are hanged. August is when Rebecca Ames is going past on the road and the other execution is going on. And then in September 8, were hanged. And at that point, there was enough opposition, like Rebecca Nurse's surviving relatives speaking against the way this was going, that the government, the governor was persuaded to put things on hold until they could get advice from abroad. So they wrote to the Privy Council and asked, what should we do with this? But, you know, it takes months to get the word over. It takes months to get the word back. And in between time, you've got months going through government channels. So they had the advice when it came was, do what you think is best. But meanwhile, winter comes on. It's cold. The jails are full. They're not constructed for long-term residence. It's it's crowded. It's nothing flushes. It's buckets for sanitation.
Yeah.
And it's cold. And this bills for blankets and firewood and stuff, but it's still not a good situation. And the older people and the are getting sick. And some people did die in jail. So they start up the trials again in January. But they are not allowed to use spectral evidence. That's the key thing. Spectral evidence being what the supposed afflicted people, and there were a lot of them. There were about 70 people at different times, not all at the same time.
They weren't allowed to use that in court?
They were allowed to use it in court. They said they saw somebody's specter coming at them and hurting them. And you're supposed to have two witnesses to things, but the second witness would be another afflicted person saying, oh, yes, I see that too. So they stopped doing that, and then they really couldn't prove much of anything. Although I think three people were found guilty, but the king's attorney, the attorney general, like an attorney general, wrote a letter to one of the judges saying that he couldn't see any difference between the evidence that was used against this one and the others.
Yeah.
So, why was she found guilty? And they postponed any more executions because 30 people had been found guilty and 19 had been hanged, and the rest of them are waiting for the axe to fall, in effect.
Jeez.
But they outlived it. And the rest of the trials for other counties, because this was in three or four counties, nobody was found guilty. And they finally cleared the jail. You had to pay rent and room and board for jail, and that's why some people stayed in longer than they needed to.
A lot of people don't realize, at this time that you're talking about, we're still a generation before Benjamin Franklin is born.
Right.
And so two or three generations prior to he and the Quakers inventing the first penitentiary, which was a long-term prison.
Right.
And so...
By the way, his aunt was one of the accusers.
Yes.
Benjamin Franklin?
Yeah.
Yes.
Wow.
Mrs. Pope, she thought she was being... this is a grown woman, not one of the girls.
Hmm.
She thought that Martha Corey was bewitching her, and she threw her... I think, at her in court.
So prisons were only short-term holding cells at the time.
Well, around that, here, anyway.
Yeah.
It was not a good situation.
They were basically designed to hold you until you either paid a fine, received corporal punishment, or were released, or you were killed.
They'd put them in jail. If somebody was held for trial, they were quarterly courts, and if somebody was taken before a magistrate and there seemed to be reason to at least try them, they'd be held until the next quarterly court or put out on released on bail. You had to put up the back pasture or money or something, and bail. But there was no bail taken for the witches.
Right. Alleged
witches.
Now, Marilyn, with all this new information coming out, and as you said, the information has been here a few years.
Yeah,
the,
19.
And you guys are helping pull it out. However, all this new interest coming out in Salem and the witch trials, what are people going to gain from reading, let's say, Six Women of Salem?
Everything. Uh-huh.
Well, I tried to show what it would have felt like, as well as the facts. What it would have felt like to be there and go through that problem. Two of the six women of the title, one's Bridget Bishop and one's Rebecca Nurse, and they were hanged. Another one is Ann Putnam Sr., who is a major accuser. She thought Rebecca Nurse was most certainly afflicting her and her family and the baby and all that. So I tried to get their different viewpoints, but also to present as much biographical fact as I could, which I was able to do more of in this than in my prior book, where I was trying to tell the whole story with a cast of thousands, practically.
Yeah, and I gotta tell our listeners, Marilyn, if you guys have not got this book that Marilyn wrote, Six Women of Salem, you have to, because I read it from front to back, And the way you detail these people's lives, like never before that I've read anything or seen any movie about it, you feel like you're sitting there with these people.
Oh, good.
You really do. You could tell that you crawled inside their heads somehow, and it's like they wrote the book. That leads me to my next question. I know we're running out of time. What was life like? Like with us today, we had the tragedies of 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
Things like that that we endure, we get through it, we have the memorial every year, and we push on and continue through life. But in a small community like Salem was, people turning on their neighbors and the families and going to the same church and the same corner stores, how did they move on from that? What was life like for these people after that?
Well, a lot of people didn't want to talk about it afterwards for many generations. Others never dropped the subject, like the Rebecca Nurse's family. And let's see, some of the people who had been widowed and widowered by the deaths that summer, let's see, George Jacobs' widow married Mr. Sarah Wilde's widower. Their former spouses both having been hanged at different times. So you kind of get the idea that the people who were on the two sides kind of kept to themselves a bit. But after a few generations, that was not so much of a problem, though they certainly remembered what had happened, because, let's see, well, this was Philip English. Philip and Mary English escaped. They were able to get out and go to New York and wait it out. But their granddaughter married Judge Hawthorne's grandson. And that kind of combined things. Yeah. But, yeah, people remembered. It was a sore point. But the people who had been condemned, found guilty but not hanged, after a while they started petitioning to have their names cleared, because technically they were, as the stepchildren of Elizabeth Proctor said, she was dead in the law, so why should we give you your inheritance? There was a little problem in that family, I guess.
Yeah.
But they didn't want to suddenly have things to change and the accusations to start up again, because technically they were under a death threat. So they started to petition the government, and in, I believe it was 11 or so, I should have, Massachusetts issued a reversal of attainder, which cleared the names of the people who had petitioned of the charge so that they could not be held responsible for this thing that they had not done, and that they should not be held accountable for it. Some of the other people had missed the petition, so it took until 2001 for five more of them to have their names cleared. But after that, the attainder, Massachusetts did make some monetary reparations for the people who had died, or, the people who had been found guilty.
Right.
Either the people who survived or the descendants and heirs of the people who had been hanged, if they had petitioned for it. And that also generates a good deal of paperwork where they say they spent X number of money going to Boston to visit mother in jail and coming back, and father was blind by then and we had to lead him, and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And there were itemized lists of what had been confiscated from the goods from the house in order to pay, your land was not confiscated, but the goods to pay bills and so forth could be.
Yeah.
And there's lists of what was taken. So,
the paperwork
has been very useful, but there was some monetary reparation.
I was reading the many articles about the new Proctor's Ledge findings, or the, you know, now we're for sure it was Proctor's Ledge.
Well, I think so.
Yeah. The families, they had to come back to get the deceased, the executed, after under nightfall. They came back at night. Some people said, no, they were buried up there at Proctor's Ledge. But why weren't the bodies buried there? could they have been buried there? Was there a church thing saying that they couldn't be buried in the churchyard because they were witches? What happened to the bodies? Did they just leave them?
This is about consecrated ground. You're not supposed to put... there was no consecrated ground and a Puritan burying ground. God made the earth, and you can't improve on that. So that was not a problem. Traditionally, felons would be buried near the gallows, or in some cases, this was later on, near the Revolution at least, sometimes a body would be sort of half preserved and left there as a warning, but that didn't happen this time either. There are strong traditions. It's a tradition, not an eyewitness account, that three of the families at least, the Proctors, Jacobs, and Rebecca Nurse's family, came back and took the bodies. And the tradition for Rebecca is in her family and in a distant relative by marriage who lived along that stretch of the road where you could see the ledge. Mr. Buffum came over and helped them. His family kept that tradition, so I think they did pretty much take them away. But one thing in all the thing about reparations and complaints and lawsuits in George Burroughs, he having been hanged too, his family kept petitioning for redress right into the 1750s. But none of that ever mentions any complaint about the disposal of the bodies.
Why do you think that is? Do you think they had to hide it?
That they were allowed to dispose of it.
Oh.
In a way that they didn't, that they approved of.
Okay.
I suspect that they didn't, that the authorities did not interfere with the families, but they may have come down by night. They may have had to wait for night. Remember, it was hot weather most of the time, so you had to do something pretty quickly.
Right. Would they just let people hang from the gallows until their neck snapped? They didn't.
They didn't. They did bring them down, according to one early account.
Okay.
And that they mention a hasty burial, but as I say, it was very hot, and I believe that was temporary. Mm-hmm. That there's nothing there now, the geophysical stuff. There was no indication of anything, and the bedrock, except to show that the bedrock is very close to the surface in the grassy parts. So that there isn't a space for a mass grave. There's no place for it.
Amazing. Nathan, any more questions?
I am trying to absorb everything I have heard this evening.
Every time, Marilyn. Well, Marilyn, I know it's on that time, and we've kept you over, milady. And you know what? I just want to say that I'm proud. I know Nathan is, too, to have you as our friend. And that that you come on the show, because you are the first and only person. I mean, you started this journey in 1975 during the bicentennial. Mm-hmm. You got involved in Salem. And now, what's it feel like? Because you're going to be able to say you were part of American History Find.
Yeah, that's pretty neat.
You are part of Salem, lady.
That's nice. I like that.
You are. I just want to say we love you to death. We support what you do, guys. Six Women of Salem. If you guys haven't read it, you got to get out now and read it. What's next for the great Marilyn K. Roach? Where do we go from here? What do we hope for Proctor's Ledge?
Well, I hope that it is not used to dump things on anymore.
Mm-hmm.
That there is a small marker of some that, lists and acknowledges what people went through there. But, that it doesn't become something overwhelmed by crowds. That it deserves respect. But, I'd put it on my bucket list, but I hope everybody does not come at once.
So you're hoping the ghost hunters don't all show up to try and talk to the dead?
Yeah.
Not in a mob.
Right, not.
And be respectful of the neighbors, too, the living as well as the dead.
Absolutely. We want to remind everybody, this is a historical site. It's a big find, and you have to be respectful, and don't flood the place. Have respect for the neighborhoods and Salem. And history.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
It's our history, people. In a country that's only 200 years old, we need as much as we can get.
Yeah.
All right. I tell you what.
Even the parts that aren't so complimentary, you learn from them.
You do. It's a huge lesson from Salem. All right. Marilyn, could you stay on the line 1 second while we close out the show?
Sure.
Marilyn K. Roach, everybody, Six Women of Salem. Nathan, what do you say?
It's that time, brother. Let's pay some bills.
Special thanks to all our homes, all our sponsors, Stitcher, Smart Radio, Planet Paranormal, Action Audio Apps. Hey, are you guys listening? They want to know. So check them out at actionaudioapps.com, Midnight Syndicate and Free Music Archives, and Kate Eppers, Salem Girl. Thanks for the tunes. From the haunted back roads of America, this has been another exclusive G&D show interview. Don't go changing America. You know we won't. Demon Hunter.
Because we love you.
Good night, guys.